You know, I'm right. The podcast that uncovers the origin stories of some of the biggest names in sports, media, and entertainment. Nick Durst here along with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, our guest today, I mean, he's somebody who's been on our list for a while now. We've had basically all of his colleagues on the show with us. So we're very happy to have him on with us now. You guys, you met last summer at the softball game, and
yeah,
this is the result of it.
Yep.
Yeah. No, thank you guys.
What's up, Mac?
What's going on, man? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, no, thank you for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
So our guest is Chris McGonigal, longtime WFAN host, now host of the Overnights. And yes, Nick is right. Last summer, you guys had the charity softball game at, what is it now? It's to me, it's always Richmond County Stadium.
Hospital
yeah.
Park.
Oh, yeah. So they had the charity softball game at St. George, and I got to meet the rest of you. Who I haven't met before, or Nick and I haven't met previously before. Like I said, Nick's met basically everybody. I've met basically everybody. You were so nice. Got some great pictures. You all agreed to come on. So the You Know I'm Right WFAN World Tour continues in 2024, and Mac is the first guy on. Mac, what's up, man? How are you?
Good, man. What's going on, guys? How are you? Yes, we had fun at that softball game. I tore my oblique or whatever I did. I was in pain for about 4 or 5 weeks straight, but feeling better since then. So, but yeah, we had fun. That was a good guy. I still managed to get the most hits on either team, by the way.
Absolutely.
So,
how did it feel being the best player on the field? Did they give you like an MVP award or trophy?
I don't know if I was the best player necessarily, but I did. I went back and checked the video because, you know, if you remember the previous show I was on, the Carton and Roberts show, I had to, pretty much fight for everything. So I would, you know, because otherwise they would try and take it down a peg on an hourly basis. So I had to go back and check the tape. And I did have 5 hits more than anyone else on the field. I don't know if I was the MVP, but yes, we had some fun. I'm a former athlete, as I try and tell everybody.
Yeah.
I had the my high school athlete of the year award in the studio for like 6 months to a year.
Just don't sell yourself short. Once an athlete, always an athlete. We got Shro Marash choice out. He's an athlete. So I think you're an athlete as well.
No. I was an athlete. Shro Marash, you know, plays, recreational flag football and calls himself an athlete. Beating Evan Robertson pickleball does not make you an athlete, I promise you.
Not a huge accomplishment. Chris, if the oblique heals up and you ever want to play, yes, you come down to Staten Island and play with me.
Oh, yeah?
And our team.
You guys play softball?
Yeah, we 3 years in a row, we got knocked out in the semifinals of the championship game. So we're looking to break that curse here.
I think Tom Izzo, who works for the station, plays softball in Staten Island. So I don't know if you guys.
Yeah,
are
I played with Tom a few times.
Yeah, apparently he's
in Sonny Carton.
Yeah,
it gets intense out here.
I know. No, right. Izzo tells me that his team is like, you know, 6-time defending champion. There's no joke.
They're in a different league with us, but yeah, they're defending champs and they take things very seriously. His team, but I played for them a bit. But the softball scene is crazy. Speaking of crazy stuff, you know, tell us about that crazy Las Vegas trip where you met Mark Melusis.
Yes.
We had Moose on the show with us a few years back. He told about the whole story, but that was kind of your introduction to WFAN, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's how I got the internship. I had I went to Connecticut School of Broadcasting. I grew up in Long Island. There's a facility in Westbury, Long Island, one of the three campuses for Connecticut School of Broadcasting. I went there. Graduated, finished the program, and I was going to Vegas with a bunch of friends. And I literally completed the program. And the next week I went to Vegas with my buddies, and the plan was to come back and start sending out resumes and trying to figure out my career. And I'm on a rooftop bar. I believe it was the MGM Grand called Pure. That was the name of the club. I don't remember the hotel 100%, but the name of the club was Pure. And we're on a rooftop bar. And my buddy points out Mark Melusis. We were all, me especially, but even most of my buddies, we were all Mike and the Mad Dog religious fans. And we would watch on Yes all the time. So we knew what Mark Melusis looked like. We knew who Mark Melusis was. So he points out Mark Melusis, and I go, well, I'm not going to bother Melusis. He's on vacation in Vegas. You know, 4 or 5 drinks in. Where is Mark Melusis? I got to go tell him I just graduated Connecticut School of Broadcasting. I'm the future of WFAN. So I'm looking everywhere for Mark at the end of the night. I'm kicking myself because I can't find him. So as I'm leaving the club, there was an elevator to get down. As I'm leaving the elevator, someone steps on a shoe, or somehow there was a little bit of an altercation in the elevator between us and some other kid, and suddenly it got cooled off relatively quickly. And the guy's like, you know, you sound like you're from New York, so am I. I'm like, yeah, I'm from New York. He's like, yeah, I'm in sports radio. I'm like, get the hell out of here. You know Mark Malusis from WFAN? And he's like, I'm here with him. And that was Brian Monzo, the future at the, you know, he wasn't yet, but the future producer of Mike Francesa, someone I worked with on a daily basis for about a decade. And that was it. We almost got into a fight in an elevator. We cooled it off. And then he took me to go meet Mark Malusis. And we met at the Horseshoe Bay, bar in the middle of whatever casino it was. We chatted it up. The next night I invited him to a club at the Hotel Wynn with me and my buddies. And I took care of him all night. He sat at our table. I fed him drinks, him and Sal Licata. Those are the two guys. So apparently Giannotti, Boomer and Gio in the morning, he was on that trip as well. They had like all lived together. They were all very close. Monzo, Licata, Giannotti. They had a place in Astoria, which was where the fan was at that time. Now we're in downtown Manhattan, but we were in Astoria back then in 2000, summer of 06. So they were all living together. They went on this Vegas trip. I bumped into them. Monzo and Gio left that next morning, and Sal and Malusis came and met us that night. So that's how I met Sal. That's how I met Moose. And they hooked me up with an internship that next winter in 07. And that's how my career got started. That if I went to the bathroom, if I decided to take an elevator 5 minutes earlier, or 5 minutes later, who knows where I would be. I'd like to think I'd be somewhere doing something. I did go to a school for it. It's not like it was just a completely out of nowhere thing. I did have a program, and I felt like I had some sort of ability, or at least a desire to work in the field, but who knows? But so I got on that elevator and it changed my life. It is the randomness of life. You never know. That's like I always tell people with that story, it's just like, not to be super corny, but like, say yes to things, because like, you have no idea. Do things, do interviews like this, like, you know, do podcasts, you know, help, you know, do whatever. You never know. You guys do this kind of thing. You never know who'll catch it. You'll never know who's listening. You never know where you'll be in the right situation, where suddenly your life will take a right turn in the most unsuspecting way. So my life completely changed 17, 18 years ago on that fateful day in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Luckily for you, what happened to Vegas didn't stay in Vegas.
No, that's true.
You know, getting the internship, I myself interned at WFAN back in 2012. And Mark was so nice, came out of his way, introduced himself to me, and just a bunch of great people working there. But how did you do what really most people who work there do? Work your way up through the behind the scenes, go from intern to I'm going to do cutting tape in the boardroom to ultimately working your way up to, we'll say, getting the board operator job. How was that process for you? How long did that take?
Yeah. Thankfully for me, unlike many people, I mean, I worked interned and part-time only a year. I started my internship that January of 07. So after meeting Moose that summer, they already had the internship planned out for that next fall or whatever. So I had to wait until the winter of 07. So I started my internship in January, and then I was full-time board op working nights for Steve Summers in December of that same year. It was relatively quick for me. Things happened. I interned, I did an excellent job. I was one of three hires from that internship class. We don't have interns anymore. I forget how many it was, but there was probably like five internships per and we had three guys hired. I was one of them. I was working part-time. And then quite honestly, the IMIS situation happened, and there was a lot of turnover, and there was a lot of people who left to do whatever with him. He had his own personal staff. There was just, John Schmelk was a producer for Steve Summers. He now works for Giants Radio. He left right at that time. So I just happened to be, I was one of the interns hired, and I felt like I did a good job and I was a good part-timer, but really I got full-time mainly because there was just happened to be a lot of turnover right in that time period. Schmelk left, a couple people left, the IMIS crew kind of left, and there was a couple of jobs left open, and I was able to get it. So I was in, most people, work part-time for forever. I mean, there's a bunch of guys who are excellent who are still at the station. They're years there where they're part-time before they're lucky enough to be hired full-time. So I got lucky with the timing as far as getting a full-time job. By December of 07, I was working nights with Peter Bellotti. He's still in the business. He's part of the morning show with Maggie and Perloff. He was with DA for all those years too on the CBS Sports Radio. So me and him both got hired at the same time. He was the producer. I was the board op for Steve Summers at night, and that's how it got started for me. But I got very lucky with the timing. Just a lot of people left, and it worked out for me. So it was quick.
Yeah. So far in your career, every time there's turnover, it's good things for you. So
it seems that way. Yeah. I just need, if people just keep leaving, I mean, it seems like they're just, you know, that's it. Who do I need to retire next? That's pretty much what I focus on.
Well, I would say it won't be long, Joe, until we see Big Mac and Gio in the morning.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I'm not so sure about that. But yes, turnovers helped me definitely, because I plugged away. I've stayed there. I've been loyal. I mean, you know, it's since January of 07. It's really the only, I mean, I've worked, you know, part-time jobs and done different side things. I worked for the Giants radio for many years. I did a couple of years working with NHL radio and Sirius and different things. But I've been an employee of WFAN, you know, 17 years. I've been plugging away at this, chasing the dream.
So you mentioned at the top, big fan of Mike and the Mad Dog. So yes, when you get the opportunity to become the board op for Mike Francesa, mm-hmm. What's your thought process there? Any nerves? And you touched it before. You and Mons, an epic duo. It's a staple together. So how was it like just building the chemistry up between the three of you guys?
Yeah, it was great. Monzo and I were friends, but I don't think we worked regularly together until then. But it was really instant and easy. And I do look back, like, you know, as everyone will, you know, do their impressions of Mike, just, you know, Mons, it's such like a common thing. I do like to think that our time together was one of the better time periods of Mike solo, at least, was the main. But yeah, I mean, I'll be totally honest with you. First thing, yeah, I'm working for Mike. That's awesome. But I had done nights and weekends for so long. Yeah. I mean, I think it was 2012 or 13. So, I mean, you're talking about 5-6 years of working Wednesday through Sunday, not having a Friday night, not having a Saturday night for years. Wow. So the first thing was just like, my hours are finally Monday through Friday. I'll have a weekend. Maybe I can find someone who will actually, like, you know, want to date me or spend time with me. Because I don't have to leave at 2 o'clock every Saturday and Sunday to head into Astoria or Manhattan. So that was the first initial positive. I finally made that next. I'm done doing the, in my opinion, some of the toughest hours. The overnight, as I'm learning, can be tough hours, but you do have your weekends. Those 4 to midnight, Wednesday through Sunday, or, you know, Friday through Wednesday, whatever the schedule is now, those are tough hours where you don't have any weekends. So that was the first thing. But yes, complete nervousness. I say this to this day, the most nervous I've ever been, more than my first show I hosted, which I did with Monzo. The first time I ever hosted a show, we did a tandem show off of the podcast we were doing, the Mac and Mons podcast. That's what got us my first show. But my first show, the first time I got, when I was told I was doing regular weekly shows on Saturday nights, like, there was never a moment in my career, my first board shift working with Steve, and Steve would be difficult too. He wanted that sound right at the instant he wants it. If there's a second of dead air, Steve would be all over you. So there were moments, but without question, hitting the button that played the music for Mike's Friday football show, when he would say, you know, when he would do you know, and in the league where they play for pay, boom, and then I would hit the button that played that music. Over the never in my life was I more nervous than the first time I hit that music. There was, and you knew, I mean, it was a special show. Mike Francesa was special. He was the heart of the station, especially, you know, there was obviously the Imus turnover. So it wasn't like that staple of the beginnings of WFM was there. Boomer and Carton were wildly successful, but Mike, to me, you know, was like the beginnings of WFAN, and who I fell in love, you know, with sports radio with those two. So yeah, it was completely nerve-wracking, but at the same time, it was excellent. It was a very easy transition. Mike, you know, was really great. It was very easy, low maintenance for the most part, except when he needed stuff. But like, it was a great experience. And yeah, I mean, it was nerve-wracking when we first started. But again, you do it together. It's me and Monzo. We were comfortable. We knew we were good at it. You know, we knew we were capable. And when you have your friend in there and you're riding with it, and you know, you're sharing the load. It's a lot easier. So, but it was a very exciting time for me when I finally got that job
and being part of the show. Here on the outside looking in, it was great for you and Mons getting those quarterly bonuses, right? Every time Mike was like, number one, no problem. Here's a bonus for the guys.
For the ratings, right? Unless, you know, I mean, but then there were times either when you didn't win the ratings, which was very, you know, was rare. It's not just sports radio. Sports radio, he won, but you were up against music stations and everything. So it wasn't every single book. It was a lot of the books. But then, you know, he would hold us hostage too. If we tied, I remember one time we tied exactly with a station and he left it up to the audience to vote on whether or not we should get our bonus. Mike was extremely generous. It was a total of 7 years between when he left, he came back. Then for a brief time, I was doing both shows. I was working on CMB and I was working on Mike because they would, you know, when he first came back, both shows were kind of sharing the afternoon. So I was working on both shows, so it was about 7 or 8 years with Mike, and it was great. It really was. It was tremendous. And he was very generous, and we won the ratings a lot. Yes.
Yes, you did. Got to talk about the exposure.
Number one.
You have to talk about the exposure to the Mike and the Mad Dog, Mike Francesa fans. Yes. And the process of having calls come in, screening the calls, having to dump calls. What was that like?
Yeah. You know, Monzo would handle most of the screening of the phone calls. I was more handling the minutes and the hours and the spots played. And, you know, Mike would break when he wanted to. So the formats go out the window. You're not following a format. You're just following Mike and you're trying to make everything fit. So it was a battle. Plus you had the element of being on television, which was really my first exposure to working with TV. I would be on the headset with the Yes Network the entire show and coordinating breaks. And so I didn't have as much contact with the actual screening of the phone calls as much, but the connection, the fans, I mean, we had the Francesa cons that he had, and the fan base was, you know, amazing. I mean, so many people were so passionate about Mike and so invested in Mike. And, you know, Mike would take us to Yankee games, or Mike would take us. So I remember when he got inducted into the New York Sports Radio Hall of Fame, Jim Nance, who was very close with him. Jim Nance was the guy who inducted him into the Hall of Fame, who made the speech and inducted him in. And we had to take a car from the station to the event. And it was like the first snowstorm of the year, and it was a disaster. And it took us like 2 hours to get across the city. And, you know, sitting in a car with Jim Nance next to me and him and Mike talking like friends, like nobody talked to Mike like friends. Like we were friendly, but it was a work relationship. I can't talk to him the way someone who's known him for 30 years and is good friends with him. So to see that dynamic of like Mike and his friend and busting each other's chops and trying to deal with the stress of getting to this event, like I'll never forget that night. But then you get there, and like as soon as you walk in, it feels like, to us, we're probably biased, but it's like, well, now the show has begun. Mike Francesa is here. Like there's a million people getting inducted, but it's you know, Mike Francesa is now here, we can start the show. And the people were crazy, and you know, people dressing up like the Pope with plastic Diet Coke Pope outfits. Like it was an outrageous experience to be a part of that. It was a lot of fun. And then his farewell tour was so great, and all the people wanted to be associated with that, and talking to so many people. Monzo did that great job of setting up that final show with all the special guest call-ins, and it was a wild ride at times, definitely. And there was a fan base, you wouldn't believe it. You show up to that Francesa con and they got someone impersonating Mike on the stage, someone's playing his intro music, live band. It was crazy.
Yeah, what a time that was, for sure.
Yeah.
Another cool thing you get to do, you're a big Giants fan, so you worked for many years on the Giants broadcast, and you don't have to pay for tickets for home games. You're on the field down there with Howard Cross. So
yes.
what was that opportunity
I mean, that was only really the last couple of years. I had been the board op for games. I had been producer on site. I'd done a myriad of different things. As I started to move up, I was taking on less responsibility there because I was, you know, doing other things, hosting shows and such. But the last couple of years, I would just, whenever Schmelk needed help, I would go do it. But I did a couple of seasons of being on the sidelines. And yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm helping Howard Cross and, you know, giving him information and holding his microphone and making sure the mic has batteries. But at the same time, I'm on the field of a Giant game. It's like one of those cool experiences. I'm on there in the pregame. I'm talking to some coaches I had an opportunity to meet with and talk with, and players and different broadcasters, and, you know, Pam Oliver, and like different people who are on the sidelines, and you're right there. And you had an opportunity to kind of mingle and see how, you know, the donuts are made pregame, on how television works and all that. So yeah, that was a very cool experience. That was, the year I did the most games of that happened to be a couple of years ago when they made the playoffs. So it was a fun year. They won a lot of games, as ugly as they were. Some of them were real slogs, but they still managed to win some games. And that, yeah, that was a fun experience. I had been with the Giants, you know, for a long time. I have a good relationship with John Smelk. He does a tremendous job. I've been through a million different iterations of that pregame show. There's been a bunch of different hosts, and that was a fun experience. But yes, I do like being on the field. It's a little bit tough, you know, now as I'm really hosting every day, you know, you miss the other games. The NFL Sunday is so what we do. I mean, it's life, you know, you want to be on your couch and not miss every other game. I got to watch the Jet games and stuff. So I probably will do that sparingly because I need to like pay attention to other things, but that is an absolute blast. And it is amazing how fast it is. Even from the stands, you go to a game, maybe if you have great front row seats, which I was never really lucky enough to have for a football game, but like on the field to see the size of the players, the athleticism of the players, and how fast that game moves in front of you is, if you ever have an opportunity, I suggest you take it. It is an experience to be on the sidelines of a football game.
Yeah, I can certainly only imagine what it's like hearing everything down there too, which is probably pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it before, you know, you had the Mac and Mods podcast, and that birthed you guys an opportunity to do a fill-in show. And I'm sure that was great. But what was it like the first time you got to do your solo fill-in show? And a lot of people have said this, but maybe not for you, but you're doing that opening monologue, the first 18 minutes or so. Any issues there? Or were you like right through all 18 minutes and then into the break? Or were you like looking up after 5-7 minutes, but like, oh my gosh, I still got to talk here to myself?
No, I feel like that part of it, once you establish really what you want to talk about, I've never really struggled with, you know, getting through a monologue. Plus I never put a time on it. The way you said 18 minutes, sometimes I am a talker. I can blab. So I will go 18 minutes or so, but I try to keep them a little shorter than that most of the time. And I never really put a timetable on it. And I think radio has changed a little bit with that. I think we've spent less time. If you listen to a lot of the shows now, more hosts and more shows are even taking calls in the open. Like it started to evolve a little bit. It's not just here's 18 minutes and then we'll go to the break. Like it's changed a little bit. But no, even when I first started, my first solo, the first show I did with Monzo happened to be the night of Alex Rodriguez's last game as a Yankee. So it was like a very easy, it's right in my wheelhouse. I'm a Yankee fan. So that was like kind of an easy thing. It was an all A-Rod, one topic kind of show. I believe the next show I did was my first solo show was a New Year's Eve or a Christmas Eve even. I remember talking Jets football for whatever reason, but no, I mean, I never get too nervous. Especially recently, a lot of these hosts, these fill-in hosts and part-time hosts who work for the station kind of either come out of nowhere or haven't had experience or are just starting and given that opportunity, which is great. I mean, but when I was around, they didn't come as easy. So I had been, you know, part of afternoon drive and talking on the mic a little bit and, you know, kind of was able to really over the course of a decade, kind of really start to eliminate the nerves of that mic being on. I mean, listen, nothing can compare you for the first time. Like even now, let's be totally honest, even now when you know, you're coming back from a break at 4 o'clock in the morning and there's not many calls up there, if calls at all. And it's like, all right, I'm coming back from break. I've kind of talked about 5 or 6 different things. The music's going to stop and I'm going to have to talk about something. Like there's still that even now. And I know working with Steve Summers, for example, like that's a man who did it for years and years and decades. And still before every show, you could see the nervous energy in him. And I have that same thing. I get made fun of a little bit, especially when I do the middays and I fill in for Sal or BT. They're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I pace a little bit before a show. I walk off some of that nervous energy. Like there's always a little bit of that because it's live and anything could happen and I could have a coughing fit. I don't know anything. Like there's always something in the back of your mind. But for the most part, no, I don't want to say it came came easy because it did not. But the nerve angle of like once I get going, it's almost like if you're doing karaoke or like a song lyric, like, oh, what's that first word? And then once you say the first word, oh, all the rest of the lyrics just kind of start to roll off your tongue. Like that's kind of how it's been for me. Like when I start, like once I get into the open, it's, you know, I sing and I do the yes, sir, whatever I do. And then once I really start talking, then it just kind of, I know where I want to go. I kind of plot out some points. I don't write, like, I don't script it, but I plot out some bullet points that I know I want to make sure I get to and try and keep it in order to see what order I want to keep them in. But for the most part, I just, you know, it's kind of that kind of thing kind of came easy where I can just yap.
So I think you touched on it a little bit, but I think through the years, personalities come, right? Some people have on-air spots and co-hosts, right? And there's this familiarity with you guys, with like Nick and I being the audience. Like we see you grow, we see you develop, we see you helping out all the big guns throughout the years. And then eventually there are those opportunities that come along and you have the opportunity to systematically kind of grow there. So you go from being an accessory to a major show to getting an opportunity to kind of do your own thing, host an hour or two, hosting a bridge show, right? Before they give you a big show. So what was it like getting the bridge show?
Yeah, I mean, well, again, that was something, and I thank, you know, both Spike. I think I was doing a little bit with Chernoff, but really that's Craig and Evan, who just felt like me and Tommy, Lou Gower, were part of the show. And on days they were off, they were comfortable with us filling in, as opposed to having, you know, the midday show get bumped up or, you know, the overnight host then stepping in, whatever it was. Like, they just were comfortable with us and they felt like that was a good opportunity. And it started with a couple Christmases. This is before the bridge show, but this is what led to the bridge show was the first idea, because that never happened. I mean, the idea of Mike taking off and me and Monzo filling in is, you're nuts. That's never going to happen. Like, my friends would suggest things, you know, because your friends are always like, oh, you're great. Why don't you? I'm like, you don't understand. Like, no, then that's not in the realm of possibility. So I remember when Craig first suggested it to us, I was like, really? Okay, that's amazing. And so once we started being comfortable and they started being comfortable with us in that time slot doing that show, then what happened with that was JJ was doing, before JJ Jastrzemski, before John Jastrzemski left, he was doing a gambling show, a DraftKings related or a FanDuel related, I don't remember. But he had like a half hour little show before baseball games or before whatever. And then when he left, that show kind of went away. I think Keith did it for a little bit. But then that half hour just opened up, and with the time frame, with the scheduling. And I guess at that point they were comfortable with me to do it. And yeah, the idea of getting regular half hour shifts, or, you know, we would play so many spots, it ended up being 10, 12 minute shifts. But having that ability to be on in, you know, afternoon drive, you know, or the closest facsimile of, on a regular basis was fantastic. I mean, I remember really, because I pushed for it too, because I knew JJ was leaving. I knew, like, I was like, if anything ever, like, I remember talking to Spike, like, I could do that, you know, half hour, you know, I would have done it pro bono. Like, I would have just to get exposure, to be out there. So yeah, the bridge show, by that point, I was probably a year or two even into doing regular. I started out doing Saturday nights and then I switched to Friday overnights just for life stuff, to have a weekend to see my kids more. I would sleep at the station on Friday nights and then just do the over. I would stay there the entire night and then just do the Saturday morning overnight, as opposed to going home and then feel, you know, that I was feeling like the entire Saturday day with my kids, I'm focusing on preparing for a show to go in Saturday night. So I was like, maybe we could switch it to Friday mornings, but I had already been doing that for a while before the bridge shows. But yeah, when I know I'm long winded, but when you first start, and you look at the schedule that they post on the, I remember the first time I was a fill-in board op for Mike Francesa and thinking, that says McMonagle right there on that piece of paper. Like, it was a big deal just to be that. So to look at a schedule that's on the wall and see my name 3 or 4 days a week at 6:30 was like very, 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 very rewarding and very, very cool. And now to see it every day is whatever the time slot, 5 days a week, I'm there. I'm the guy. They're doing playing promos for me like that. It's crazy. But yeah, it started with that bridge show, the idea of being a regular as opposed to just like, you know, once a week on the weekends, like right there, Monday through Friday, there's my name on the sheet 2 or 3, 4 times a week. Was awesome. It was just awesome.
So what's your reaction then when you find out you're getting the overnight shift? Obviously, you knew things must have been in the work. Craig's leaving, I'm sure. Maybe some other people were in Spike's office. But ultimately, the decision is it's going to be you. So how did you react to that?
Yeah.
How did your wife and family take it now that it's going to be a
couple of
different hours?
Yeah. So, we got the news that Craig was leaving. I will just say I'll make the one joke because they called me into the office that day. We had found out, you know, the story broke that Craig was going to leave and take the TV deal full time. So I think I walked into the office and I said, you know, Chris, I want to talk to you. And I said, I think I joked. I said 10,000 less than Craig. I'll sign right now. No problem. But they didn't offer me the afternoon drive show. So they talked to me, you know, they told me how much they value me and how much, I've grown doing the Carton and Roberts show. And my reaction was, you know, I'm pretty surreal. I had hoped that would be the case. And then, like, there wasn't a lot of pomp and circumstance. I didn't walk in and, you know, they didn't open a box and balloons went flying everywhere. Like, it was just a regular meeting. We're making some changes. Congratulations. We'd like to offer you the overnight gig. Are you interested? And I said, of course, of course. I shook hands. It's a little bit of a blur, kind of. And then it started right away. I actually started about 3 weeks before everybody else. They started like July 24th and I started July 10th during the All-Star break. So there was nothing going on. I had my first shift was 5 straight 5-hour shows with no games on, nothing to watch in the middle of baseball season, no other sport going. I mean, like, I really, that was baptism by fire. I got, you know, 20, you know, 5 times 5, 25 real quick. Yeah. 25 hours on my first week of not a game to react to other than the All-Star game and home run derby. And like, you know, so it really did happen fast because it was like Craig left. Here's the gig. Start on Tuesday. Like it was that kind of thing. So, but it was amazing. I mean, it's literally, you know, it's a 17-year dream that I've been chasing. So to get it on any level, to be a mainstay, to be one of the main everyday hosts, overnight host on WFAN. I mean, you had Steve Summers, Joe Beninco, Tony Page, Mark Malusis, Evan Roberts did it for a time. I mean, these are all guys who I admire and have gone on to do more. So it feels like, and have great careers that we all, you know, they're beloved figures. So it was a surreal moment, but also it was, you know, it was let's get to work. Like I really wanted to make sure I hit the ground running and you know, proved it. So it's one of the great moments of my life. And then the family, I waited a day or two and I told my wife, and you know, the hours are different, but also like as a father of two young boys, I see them so much more now. I live in upstate New York. If you're a fan of the Carton and Roberts show, I'm sure you're aware, you know, I have my wood guy and I'm up in the woods. It takes me even no traffic in the middle of the night. It's 1 hour and 20. So it takes me some time to get to the station. So when I was doing afternoon drive show, it ended 6:30. Then I would have a bridge till 7, you know, towards the end there. I'm not getting home until 8:30, 9 o'clock. I walk into my kid's bedroom, kiss him goodnight. And that was it. Like, you know, and in the morning I would take him to school. But even then it was like, you know, quick. So now I come home and I have plenty of time with them in the morning. I'm kind of waking up as they're coming home from school. I put them to sleep and then I go to work. So we knew that as far as like the burden on my wife of taking care of the boys all day was going to be, you know, helped. And I was going to be much more around here, which is, you know, tremendous. It helped my family life. The hours of sleep I'm still dealing with. I don't know if I'll ever get completely used to it. But you know, we knew that it was going to help that way. I was going to see the boys. I was going to be home for dinner. I was going to be able to do things. I mean, me and my wife don't, you know, sleep in the same bed very often, only on the weekends. But like, besides that, like I feel more connected to my family than ever. So it's been great. And they were, you know, excited for me. My wife's been with me. Obviously I met her in 2010. So I was chasing this, you know, she knew exactly what I was trying to do when she met me. So to finally reach that. I mean, it was great. It was a very nice dinner. I took my mother out too, and I told everybody that, you know, my job is going to change and I'm full time at the Fan. So it was a great moment. It was great.
Awesome to hear. So for you, when you're taking calls, what's your favorite type of caller? What's your least favorite type of caller? Me as a listener, I can't stand the guys who say, well, I used to play high school football, or George was still alive. Those are my two least favorites. What are your favorites and least favorite type of callers?
Yeah. All right. Well, just type of caller, without getting into the because you did mention one that bothers the heck out of me. But yeah, the caller who needs to give you his resume of his fandom, it's tired, it's old, we get it, you've been a fan since forever. That doesn't make you an expert on what's going on right now. We're not having a conversation about Tom Seaver at the moment. We can at times. And then if you want to tell me you were around to see Tom Seaver, then it's relevant. But on the current Met team, I understand you're a Met fan. If you're calling me at 2:30 in the morning to passionately discuss the Mets, you've got it. You're granted. I assume you're a big-time Met fan. You don't have to sell me on it. But for me, I don't want to say combative, but I like the calls that challenge me. I like the calls who disagree with me, who give me a counterpoint to discuss, because, you know, as much as I, you know, here's a little secret, as much as I pretend to be, I know I'm not infallible, and I know my opinions are my opinions, and that they could very well be wrong. I wanted the Giants to trade for Russell Wilson a couple of years ago. I mean, I can be dead wrong. And but you got to have the bravado, otherwise it's not fun. So I like the callers who will, not necessarily looking for a fight, but looking to make a counterpoint and looking to really, even if they agree with me, to tweak it a little bit or have something to say. I mean, that's really the main thing I look for in a caller. Let's be honest. I look for someone who's going to bring something to the program, an opinion I disagree with, an opinion I can take further, have a discussion with, like. The callers who call up and just say, do you think the Yankees can win the World Series? I mean, we can have that discussion, but, you know, that's not, you know, the Yankees are going to win the World Series and here's why, or, you know, Rodon is going to screw us again this year, or, like, I don't know. That's better than just, what do you think, Chris? Like, so I want to know what they think. So callers who come with actual, like, opinions and looking to either, you know, challenge me or, you know, have their own viewpoint and be passionate with it. Those are the best callers. Those are the callers that further the conversation. And I love the callers, but one of the things I wanted to make sure I did with the overnight is, because we all know, you know, the callers aren't the same in the afternoon, the volume of them. It's just the nature of the business. I'm not ashamed to say it. It's just the honest to God truth. So I never wanted to get to a place where I'll hang on to a call that shouldn't be on the air just because I don't have one in the dock. You know, I don't want to, like, I take the call for as long as I find that call to be valuable to the show, and then I move on. And if that means talking to myself, that's what it means. But, like, those are the best calls. But yeah, if you're talking about, like, subtle things or topics, or, like, yes, the George would be rolling over in his grave is something that bothers the hell out of me. The resumes. One thing I love, and I'm so fascinated, and this is funny to me. The caller who comes on and thanks me, but calls me their own name. It happens a lot. Like, if you were to call me and go, hey, Joe, what's going on? I mean, Chris, like, people say their own name. It happens like once a week. And I'm so fascinated why that's an actual thing and a trend. And it's not the same people doing it over and over again. Like, there's a nervous thing where I guess they repeat their name that I just said, or like they're like, but that's one that, like, every time it happens, I make a point of it, because I find it hilarious that they would call me their own name. Like, I get this one guy keeps calling me Sal. He can't get over that Sal's not the overnight host anymore. That's fine. I understand that. He just is used to calling Sal. But, like, someone who would call in and go, yeah, hi, Nick. I mean, Chris, like, that, you know, I find it very fascinating. And that happens like once a week. So I'm always, and then I try and ask them, like, why did you say your name? And they have no idea, but it's very funny to me. It happens all the time.
I'll tell you something, Joe. Mac, that's a very fascinating trend.
It happens all the time, and I find it really funny. I don't know why that's an actual thing, but it is. People they say their own name. It must be that they're, like, playing it back because I just said it. I don't know, but, like, it happens a lot, and I find it very fascinating. But, yeah, no, as long as if they just come with, you know, an actual thing, wanted to talk, don't have to give me the resume, don't have to, you know, say anything cliched or anything. I you know, calls are great. I they're such a huge part of the overnight, and such like it's a family. Like I have the same regular callers all the time. Like we, you know, I have Maury, who we do the Tonight Is Your Night, Bro, which is a thing from Twins, the movie. Like there are just things like that. We have our own. There's a guy, Stu. I call him Stu Pot. Like there's just like we have like a real almost a relationship because I talk to them on a daily basis. So the calls are very, very important. I love, you know, I appreciate them all. Anyone who's willing to call me at 4 o'clock in the morning. But at the same time, yeah, one more thing, since you're honestly asking me, don't call up if you're looking like for things for me, at least don't call up and tell me you have 5 bullet points. Let you get to all of them. Like I can't promise you that. Like I can't promise you like you're looking for me. All right, listen, Chris, I got 4 things. I'll be real quick. No, I can't guarantee you get to all 4. If 1 is great, you get to 2. If 2 is good, you get to 3. If 3 is good, you get to 4. But like if it over the course of the conversation, I can't just guarantee you're getting all those points. I have 2 questions and a comment. Start with question 1. We'll see where we go. Like I just like they look for affirmation, or they think if they say that, I'll somehow allow them to get to all of it. And not that I'm looking to not allow it, but it is what it is. If you're great and we have fun and the call's good, you can make 10 points. I'll take you for 10 minutes if I think it's good. But like they'll do that and they'll think that like if they tell me I got 5 points, I'll be all right, okay. I mean, 3 is awful, but what's 4? Like not all the time. Sometimes, but not all the time.
So you talk about building relationships with the people who call in, building strong bond relationships with those callers, building strong bonds and relationships with your coworkers. You touched on it before, your relationship with Mike, how close you are with him, how close you've been with him through the years. In the later years, your relationship with Craig before he recently left the station last year. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk to you about how often do you still speak to Mike? How often have you spoken to Craig since he's left the station to pursue the Fox opportunity full time? Yeah. How often do you talk to those guys?
Yeah, I mean, not all the time. It's not, we wouldn't communicate outside of work that much, you know, anyway. So it's not like suddenly our relationship has changed all that much. We would see each other every day.
Right.
So I've probably talked to Craig 5 or 6 times since, but mostly side things, funny things. Saw this, thought of you, it was hilarious. Like nothing too like real. Like, so, you know, how's life? I heard the show this morning. A couple of things I've asked him for advice on certain things. But more the relationship with Craig was more of like that. Like, you know, if I saw like a food thing or a sandwich thing, I'd be like, bro, you got to see this. Or like, we talked about P. Alonzo once, but like for the most part, just kind of like casual fun stuff a couple times. Mike, I spoke to Mike for Mike is, it's usually in clusters with Mike where something will happen and then we'll end up talking like 5 or 6 times within a day or two. And then it'll be a while before we speak again. But I'm on good relationships with both of them. Mike and I spoke for, you know, several times on several different things when I got the job in July. So we had kept in communication for like maybe 3 weeks on like a bunch of different stuff for a while. But like, yeah, I mean, I know I can always go there if I wanted to. Like that's pretty much it. Like me and we're close. I was sending Craig a lot of audio before I got the job, you know, sound checks and stuff. And I've sent Mike some stuff too, but now it's more just casual whenever I want to reach out and talk baseball. That's really Mike and I's biggest connection. So since the baseball season, not much, but Mike and I typically will talk Yankees. So when the baseball season starts up, hopefully I'll talk to him more, but not a daily or weekly or even monthly relationship, but when it's there, I know it's there.
Awesome. And it's good to have friends like that. I mean, my daily friends, like people I talk to every day, I can go months without seeing anyway. So it all makes sense. Chris, for you in your life, for your career, what would you say is your right moment? What I mean by that is a time or place where you wanted to pursue something, you asked somebody for advice, whether it be a friend, family member, a colleague, they said, Chris, that's an awful idea. Don't even think about that. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway. And in the end, you will see why it is that I'm right.
Right. Times I turned down advice. I was back in the day, I was offered the overnight producer job that is now filled by the great Michael Fliegelman, who works with me on a nightly basis. that job came up, and before, I don't know if you remember Russell Mathis, but Russell Mathis ended up getting the job, but the job came up, and everybody told me you have to show initiative. So you got to go out for the job. And at the time I'm working nights, and I feel like, you know, sometimes in the overnight, you don't see the bosses, or like, I just felt like I didn't even know how I felt about it, that change at that moment in time. And a lot of people told me I had to go for it. And I did. And I remember I was kind of offered the job, and I ended up, you know, kind of turning it down. And I remember in that moment thinking, no, because then once I get that job, I don't know if the mic thing happens. I don't know if, you know, working in the afternoon happens. Like, I just felt like I was in a good spot, seeing the people I wanted to see and needed to see me on a daily basis. So nobody really, like, it's the first thing that pops into my head. Nobody told me you have to take it, but it was like, you should go for it. Like, you should really go for it. And I was even hesitant to that, but it was like, if you're not interested in jobs, what are they going to think of you? You got to show that you're initial, you know? So I did it. And then ultimately I was kind of like, nah, I wanted the experience to talk to you, and I'm thrilled that, you know, you think of this much of me, but I'm kind of okay where I am. And it was an awkward moment for a second, but like, I felt like that was kind of the moment. Cause I don't know. I might still be the overnight producer. I don't know. Like, that ended up leading to the afternoon drive thing, and ended up leading the mic. And so I would say that moment in my career, in my life, they said, no, don't be the MVP of your football team. And I said, I'm sorry. I have to be. I know you guys are wrong. I can be the MVP of my football team playing offensive line. I can. And sure enough, I was right.
Perfect podcast for that. Yeah. Mac, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Of course, man. Thank you, guys.
Stories. There was a lot of turnover at WFAN last summer, mm-hmm. right? And usually seismic shifts like that come once every 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so the night show changed. The morning, the midday show changed, the afternoon drive show changed. A lot of things changed in a very quick period of time. And a lot of people there who have been really hustling and grinding and waiting for their times to shine, got their times to shine. And I listened to some of your early shows around the time that you mentioned before, right, at the All-Star break last year, and periodically listened to you. I haven't really called in yet, but I just want to say you're doing a great job. I think everybody's doing a great job. There'll always be haters on the internet. There'll always be people who think they know the fan better than the people who work for the fan.
But I don't know what you're referring to. Are people negative on social media?
I mean,
everyone loves me. I don't know.
That's a place you should stay off that.
You think people just think that? I mean, it's amazing. It's really. I one last little funny story. I told it last night. Actually, I bumped into a guy who. I knew he helped me like put my kid's swing set together. Like, he's a guy from the neighborhood I haven't seen in a while. And I was at the grocery store yesterday, and he bumped into me and he said, "Hey, what's going on?" I'm like, "Nothing." He goes, I heard you with Sal the other day. It was tremendous. I thought you did a great job. I recently, last Friday, filled in for BT with Sal. And he said, "You did a great job. I loved it." I'm like, "Thank you." He goes, "Why does everybody hate Sal?" I'm like, "I don't think everybody does. I think there's a very vocal minority that love to take the Twitter, because I said, like, very few people take the Twitter to go, Sal is the best, McMonagle's awesome. Like, nobody, like, the people who are angry or bitter or think they have something funny to say, those are the people who go to social media and decide. Like the same thing with reviews. I'm always leery of reviews for restaurants or something. Like, who takes the time to tell you what a great experience they had? Not nearly as many that would tell you how awful it was. Like, so I'm always hesitant with that. But yes, yeah, you deal with it. If nobody's mad at you, you're probably not doing it right. So that's how, sure, I like to look at it.
But it's still small minority.
I think so. I like to think so.
You guys are great hosts. Thank you. And a bunch of you have been great guests on this podcast, and we thank you for your time. I hope to see you guys again this summer, maybe for the softball game again, but hope to see you guys again in the future.
Yeah, I'm game for whatever nonsense they throw at me. So yeah, I'll do whatever. Maybe you'll see us at a curling tournament. I'm not sure.
Chris, but you gotta start the kickoff to summer. Start it at midnight. Do it. Everyone will come out at midnight. Yeah.
I wish they would let me do it from midnight. No, but I'll tell you what, if they allow me, I'll talk to Evan and Tiki if they are so inclined to continue that show. I'll still go there, and if they let me, I'll sing live like I have the last 2 years. I'll try and keep that tradition. But so yeah, if you guys are going to go there, I would imagine I'll try and make it there. So
absolutely.
Thank you guys very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Mac. All right. Does anything else you'd like to share or promote?
No. Check me out every Monday through Friday, either two
listen
or
to the overnights.
Listen to the overnights on WFN. Nothing as of right now, no.
All right. Well, Chris, I'm looking forward to the summer where we're going to hear you in the daytime a lot, I'm sure.
Hopefully. Which
is better for my schedule. But this has been great, Chris. I'm sure Joe will be calling in soon to talk about Spencer Jones and why Patrick Mahomes and Daniel Jones are in the same hemisphere. But that's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right for our very special guest, Chris McMonagle, and my co-host, Joe Calabrese. I'm Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.